now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Happy Monday, everybody. Hello, I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio, and welcome to the show, where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Jazz fusion pioneer, drummer, percussionist, composer, and bandleader Billy Cobham has for decades been respected as one of the greatest drummers on the planet. Born in Panama and brought up in Brooklyn, New York, Cobham got his first paying gig at the age of 8 as a member of St. Catherine's Queensmen, a drum and bugle corps in St. Albans, Queens. Billy attended New York's renowned High School of Music and Art, where he studied music theory and drum technique. While in the military, Cobham played with the U.S. Army Band as percussionist. After the military, Cobham began working in the Horace Silver's Band. He also performed with Stanley Turrentine and Shirley Scott and recorded with George Benson. In 1969, Billy Cobham co-founded the jazz rock combo Dreams. The band featured Randy Brecker, Michael Brecker, John Abercrombie, Don Gralnick, Barry Rogers, and Will Lee. The following year, he was invited to join Miles Davis's new fusion ensemble. Cobham contributed on Live Evil, a tribute to Jack Johnson and the Bitches Brew sessions, where he collaborated with guitarist John McLaughlin. In 1971, John McLaughlin formed the jazz fusion Mahavishnu Orchestra with Billy Cobham, Jan Hammer, Jerry Goodman, and Rick Lehrer. The original lineup released three critically acclaimed albums: The Inner Mounting Flame, Birds of Fire, my favorite, and Between Nothingness and Eternity, a live album released in 1973. In 1973, Billy Cobham released his debut solo album entitled Spectrum. The album was recorded at Jimi Hendrix's Electric Lady Studios in New York City. Cobham's core lineup for the album featured guitar virtuoso Tommy Bolin, Jan Hammer on electric piano, Moog synthesizer and piano, Lee Sklar on bass, and the album featured an incredible mix of jazz, funk, and rock. The recording was hailed as one of the most important albums in the development of the jazz fusion genre and jazz rock era. Also in 1973, Cobham toured with John McLaughlin and Carlos Santana, performing material from the Love, Devotion, Surrender album. During the 70s and 80s, Cobham recorded for Atlantic, CBS, Elektra, and GRP. He collaborated with George Duke, John Scofield, Tony Williams, Jack Bruce, and the Grateful Dead spinoff band Bobby and the Midnights. In 1992, Cobham was appointed to work with UNICEF to work with autistic patients and street children in Santos, Brazil, in a musical project, Rudiments, the Billy Cobham Anthology, two-CD retrospective, was released in 2001. In 2002, Billy Cobham began releasing a series of CDs with special guest artists entitled Drum and Voice. By 2005, Cobham had recorded and released over 30 recordings under his name. In 2013, Billy Cobham celebrated the 40th anniversary of the release of Spectrum CD by touring the USA, Canada, and Europe with the Spectrum 40 Band. Also that year, Purple Pyramid Records released the Billy Cobham Compass Point 2 CD set, recorded live at Compass Point Hotel in the Bahamas in 1997, which was never released before. Early 2014 marked the release of the much-anticipated Tales from the Skeleton Coast, which is the third installment of the four recordings produced as a commemoration and celebration of Cobham's mother and father, both of whom were musicians. In the summer of 2014, Cobham released a live CD recording from the celebrated Spectrum 40 tours, which dazzled audiences around the world. In commemoration of the 40th anniversary of Spectrum CD, the defining album of the jazz fusion genre. jazz fusion pioneer Billy Cobham will bring his highly acclaimed art of the Rhythm Section Retreat back to the Mesa Arts Center for its second year, offering an immersive educational program for drummers, bassists, guitars, and keyboard players. In the words of program founder Billy Cobham, the unique format of the program allows participants to explore and expand their artistry, develop and refine their band and focus on all important elements of teamwork and collaboration so that all types of instrumentalists can benefit and learn from the perspective of each one of our coaches. The retreat will also offer a musician in enrichment program, social media on steroids, conducted by marketing expert Dan Schinder, to help musicians better leverage social media in promoting their music and their brands. The Billy Cobham Art of the Rhythm Section Retreat culminates with a special Saturday night performance with Billy and the Spectrum 40 Band at the Mesa Arts Center on Saturday, July 22nd, in the Piper Theater at 7:30 p.m. Enrollment for the programs is now open, with spaces limited for each of the four instrument categories of drums, guitar, bass, and keyboards. For more information and to register, visit www.billycobhamretreat.com. It is my great pleasure to welcome legendary drummer, percussionist, composer, producer, and educator Billy Cobham to the Ray Shasho Show. Hello, Billy.
Hi, Ray. Boy, how do you do that, man? That's amazing what you've done. I tried to count the amount of times you breathed in between paragraphs. That's absolutely off the hook, man.
Well, just like you are a trained musician, I went to broadcast school.
They teach that there? I thought it was only for peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and, you know, and then an occasional glass of milk. I didn't know.
Man, it's so good to talk to you again. You are one of the best interviews I've ever had, and I've interviewed over like 500 legendary artists. You're just such a nice guy. You never look your age, and it was great to actually talk to you last time through a Skype interview, so we got to see each other, and there was a huge thunderstorm while we were talking, so that was a fun time as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, actually, you know, I mean, I don't want to let out too many secrets, but I mean, as looking my age, yeah, I'm old. Yeah, that's how I look. that's about it.
You don't look it, man. I tell you, you know, you look like you're like in your early 50s.
Okay. Let's keep it down.
it's got to be a Panamanian thing, man.
Oh, man. Oh, whatever. We aim to please, and, you know, I like peanut butter and jelly as well, so it's no problem. let's get out of business, man. What we got to do?
Let's talk about the Billy Cobham Art of the Rhythm Section Retreat. That is so cool, and it's in its second year, correct?
Yes, sir. And what I'm so excited about with the Art of Rhythm Section Retreat is that it's bringing to the surface aspects of performance and musicianship that really, I don't think anybody meant to bury it or not to talk about this in schools. I don't know a lot about what the curriculum is in most music schools and conservatories, but as far as I'm concerned, these questions that are posed and points that are posed by me and my associates when we're working in this immersive of 5 days, it's just basic stuff like, what do you hear? Why do you play what you play? How are you affected by your colleagues, and how do you affect them in return in terms of your call and response between each other? These things were even touched upon, no one knew. No one talked about it. And so for me, these are things that I remember as having to learn in the most honest and respectful way, raw as it would be, way that we could. And that was on the bandstand, in observance of what was happening and how to make adjustments from one gig to the next. And I decided to kind of, in a way, put it in the proverbial bottle and say, okay, fine, I have some questions. Let's see if we can't answer these. And by the way, it'll cost you a little bit. because this is coming from my experiences, you guys, what I've gone through. And if you really are truthfully believing in what I've done and you applaud what I've done, I'm willing to share this with you in some way. Sometimes it's not about money. It's about the actual the money being a representation of when I see someone as a student, or for lack of different term, take something that I've offered and use it and be successful, then I've been paid. Right. All I can do is just smile. And that's where it all starts, you know, because if you're doing things you like and you've learned how to do that, no matter where it comes from, but you can share the positive, then it means that the business that we're in of music will only prosper from that. Mm-hmm. And that's my objective, is to try to make that flower blossom where it hasn't before, and if it has before, to keep it strong enough so that it will not close down. Because in our lives today, more than ever, we need music, I'll tell you.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Now, these guys are going to be advanced students, pretty much, right? And you might have some semi-pro guys, some professional musicians as well, right?
Well, we will have very good players, young musicians, who may have been recommended by their instructors.
Okay.
We are hoping to have their instructors come.
Oh, really?
Because we want to show teachers how to teach better.
Right.
You know, it's not about just the book. We want to actually go, okay, look, you know, check out this Miles Davis Kind of Blue, something like this.
Right.
What do you see there? How would you analyze what they've done? Jimmy Cobb, Paul Chambers, Miles Davis, Bill Evans. How did they create that feeling? You know, where did it come from? What are they saying? How are they communicating with each mm-hmm. other through the notes? If you like what you hear and you can analyze it to some degree, can you emulate that? Can you imitate what they've done in your own way? And that's what we go. We start from there. We take a little bit of that, and then we say, okay, fine. You've seen that. Now, what's the difference between that and this? And we put on Steely Dan, Hey 19. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, everybody's head is bobbing up and down, you know. So we've gone from a ballad, which is Kind of Blue, to a groove. But yet, in the ballad, your head wasn't bobbing up and down if you really enjoyed the ballad, if you understood what was being presented to you, but you were immersed in the music as a whole. Now, you go to Hey 19, and you're immersed in the music again. But this time your body is saying, okay, this is how I like to walk. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't drag my feet in the ballad, but I understand why the ballad is moving slowly. It's all about the feeling and the love. Hey 19 is about the feeling and the love too, but in a happy way. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you sustain that? How do you create that with your fellow players? And this is what the Art of the Rhythm Section Retreat is promoting. How to communicate and interact with people whom you've never heard play before, how they function, how they relate to you, how you can hit the ground running right away and create this feeling. What does it take?
That's a fascinating way of teaching. It really is, because nobody wants to sit there with a bunch of notes in front of them, you know, like an orchestra, you know, and play this, you know?
No. Well, you see, that's the thing about the notes that's very important. It's put there as a guide. When you play those notes and you string them together, you get the personality that's coming from the sounds.
Right.
But now you have to interpret that and put it in and present it in your own personal way. And if you don't know how to do that, then it's only going to be notes on a paper, and it's only one-dimensional.
Right.
But as soon as you know how those notes are supposed to be presented, that means phrasing and the dynamics of playing, the tempo, of course, is important, the sustaining of the tempo, but understanding why you have to do all of those things in order to make that presentation is the most important thing. And if you can get those things, if you have those things all lined up in your head, you'll never be unsuccessful in performance.
You learn a lot about that probably from Miles too, right? Because I heard you in a couple of interviews talk about where Miles would just kind of point at you. It's like, your turn, you know, do your thing, you know. And
And what he was doing was he was conducting.
Right.
If I don't know if you've ever seen the video of Maestro Bernstein, who conducts with his face. He only smiles. He only smiles. He only looks with his eyes.
Right.
At the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. And they're doing something absolutely stupid, complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for those who listen, and to see him not move his hands, but to smile and to show that what's complicated about it is that he's showing the emotions
mm-hmm.
of how the music is supposed to come across via the instrumentalists who are playing it as a unit, okay? When Miles does it, he knows what I'm gonna play already.
Right.
He knows my personality.
Right.
So I'm playing a certain kind of figure, and he knows when he wants me to change or something like this, so he'll body language. But he's going with the music, you know? I read in Herbie's book, where Herbie Hancock's book, where he talked about the many times that a lot of the tempos that were played with Ron Carter and Wayne Shorter in the band and Tony were so that Miles could take advantage of the fluidity of Tony's performance, because Tony loved to play fast. He was young, he was in a hurry. I mean, even if you look at the title of some of his records, one record's called Emergency, you know. It's like the rabbit, that came out of the hole with a big pocket clock.
Right.
You know, I'm lit. And he's burning all the way, you know, and it's all very sincere. Miles knew this, so everybody played that fastball until finally everybody said, come on, man, you know, it can't all be up tempo. But when you listen to things like albums like Four and More, the album, even My Funny Valentine, you'll hear a ballad that's played up tempo. That makes all the sense in the world, but it is just the way it came out. It was more like the Tony Williams Band featuring Miles Davis for a while, you know, because he was young, he was fresh, and he was what Miles perceived as being needed to take the music in a different direction, of which it did. And hence, you know, with ESP, we have what we have now called fusion, because that was the very, very first fusion album.
Yep. And thanks to Spectrum.
Well,
I give Spectrum
a
lot of kudos.
Yeah. I think that Spectrum was I was just very fortunate I can't say enough. I'm very thankful. You know, if everything stopped tomorrow, I had a good time. It's been some good stuff. I've made some good music and played with some very fine players, and so I'm quite happy.
Yeah, I always tell people Spectrum album came out in '73. Let's see, Mahavishnu was '71. Jeff Beck releases Blow by Blow in '75.
Right.
And the media calls him a genius. I mean, what happened to Billy Cobham?
Well, Billy Cobham didn't have the marketing apparatus that Jeff Beck has.
Yeah, I guess not.
That's
huh?
what happened. No, I don't have to guess. I know. So therefore, you know, nobody's knocking on my door with any awards, really. But that's okay. I mean, my award is not the material. My award is when somebody says, hey, I like that record. That's good enough for me. I'm good.
You really get a kick out of having people learn what you teach them now, which is awesome. You know, we need more people like you in music, because you know how music is kind of.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's very, very. It's a very rewarding feeling.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when you sit down with somebody and you say, okay, but they say, well, I want to take a lesson, and you go, why? And they said, well, I want to study with you. Why? What I want to learn how what you know. Why? Okay. He said, because you're doing this, that, or the other thing. I said, okay, show me what you mean by that.
Right.
He said, well, I said, what is the problem with you? You seem like you can play pretty good. Oh, I want to learn hand technique. I said, well, what kind of technique with the hand would you need without the feet? Silence. So, you don't use your bass drum, or you don't use your hi-hat very much. You hold keep your foot on the hi-hat as if you don't want it to go anywhere. You don't ever bring it up or down, so you never have a sound coming out of the cymbal.
Right.
What about playing the bass drum instead of trying to kick the bass drum beat through the bass drum head? How about playing the bass drum? So you bring so every beat or every stroke that you put your foot down and up on is one that you really mean to do. There's silence again. So okay, fine, I got something for you. Okay, we'll start there. And we'll start to work on just keeping what Papa Joe Jones and Art Blakey and all my mentors used to call four on the floor. Can you play four on the floor? One, two, three, four, one, two, three, four. And just to sustain that while you have the hi-hat playing on beats two and four. One, two, three, four, one, two. And sustain that and use that then. Once you get to a point where you can control those two rhythms as your metronome, can you do that? And this is where we start. And when I see that there is progress being made, I've got my reward. Because yep. I've just given somebody something that they never had before,
right,
or couldn't understand how to do because they didn't have the key. They didn't understand the reason why they needed to do it. But the key to all of that is we all are born with a clock in our minds.
Mm-hmm.
It's in our brains. And it's that same clock when you don't have a watch. And if you're hungry and you know that if you wake up at a specific time in the morning, you can go to the bakery and get freshly baked bread, but you have to get it between a 15-minute period. And that might be around between a quarter to six and 6 o'clock. If you get there after 6 o'clock, all of that stuff's sold. So therefore, you're going to get up early enough to get your clothes on and get over there by a quarter to six, even if you have to stand in line. And now the problem is, how do I know it's a quarter to six? Uh-huh. All of a sudden, the mind starts to think, well, you know, the light is at a certain point on the horizon, just around that time in my party. And all of a sudden, you start to remember that. Why? Because you need to eat something between 7 o'clock and so forth. So you go and you get this bread, and you did it all without a clock, because the clock is in your head. It's not a mechanical clock. And when you play the drums, you have that same clock that manages how you synchronize yourself internally.
What are you thinking about when you play the drums? What's in your head?
How the music is treated or should be treated, and how I can contribute, not just rhythmically, but musically, which means all my drums must be in harmony, in sonic harmony with the music. So it means I have to tune the drums. Okay, how I approach playing the drums to enhance what my fellow players are presenting.
Right.
Not if it means to play with strength, it doesn't always mean to play loudly.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't always mean to play quickly. Sometimes, for instance, I just made a recording with the producer of Pink Floyd, James Guthrie, and he wanted me to play first with sticks in a treatment of a piece that was written. And as it turned out, that piece needed brushes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very rare that I'm asked to play brushes on a recording session.
Right.
For the last 20, 30 years, man, people go, who needs brushes? You know. But that's because they don't understand what one can accomplish. And it's not the instrument, the brushes.
Right.
It's who's using them.
Right, right.
And so The whole objective was to find a way to bring in some person kind of personality that it encompassed still the feeling and security of controlling the tempo, of synchronizing with the other art, with the other sounds, while presenting this personality that was kind of elusive and mysterious, yet it all seemed to work to enhance the actual overall musical picture.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I choose. That's where I find myself being, successful in achieving my goal.
Right.
To play musically in that way. I want to be able to urge my fellow players on, my colleagues, so that they do what they feel they can do because they're comfortable with where and that they know that I'm in sync with them. And so when I get that, then everything's easy. We're painting a picture all together, you know, in the creation of this sonic portrait is the personalities who make it up. At that point in time, it's a band with no name, but it doesn't matter what the name is.
It's just
who we are, and that's what we're all about. That's what drumming. That's what I try to do when I play.
Now you guys are going to have up to 30 guitarists, 30 keyboardists, mm-hmm. and 30 bass players, and 30 drummers, correct? That'll fill it up. The price of this thing is cheap, in my opinion. It's very reasonable. For 5 days, learning from the best, I mean, $1,250, that's, these rock and roll fantasy camps and baseball camps, they're over $3,000, you know, and this is something you're going to take away for the rest of your life, you know, so it's a great deal. It really is.
There you are. And the whole objective is to help to. That's why I said that the teachers are important to come because it's about them.
Right.
Once they learn this, it's theirs. They can take it anywhere they want.
Exactly.
I don't get a royalty. My royalty is to see them put it into action, and see the students that come back to me and say, "Hey, I studied with X, Y, and Z, and they went to your camp." And so they told me that I should come and learn. Now I'm paid. There's my reward. That's what I'm talking about.
Yep.
You know? And so these points and ideas and thoughts to put into action to show people where they can go based on what they already have to work with, it's only making the business, the art form, the business of music,
right.
The whole concept of thought, philosophy on all levels just grow. And this is where we want to go.
You've got are there going to be like little techniques? I mean, a lot of drummers know already, but you know, like what's the best way to tame a snare buzz? You know.
No, we're not going there. Doing is taking. We're talking about. What's the best way to use a snare buzz so that it is musically enhancing what's happening? Okay.
Right.
So it's about you. It's all about you listening and understanding your instrument,
mm-hmm.
and saying, okay, I got this problem. Do I need the problem? Is it a problem negatively or is it a positive problem?
Right.
Can I use it in music that I'm playing right now in real time?
Right.
Or do I have to change the snare drum? That's all. You know, or can I use brushes as opposed to this? But this is how I want to sound. The more all these things come into being, you know, what we're going to be dealing with in July is even the whole idea of how the acoustic drum set has sustained itself because it had to. It can't play itself. But now we have these things called electric drums.
Mm-hmm.
What do they do? And they don't do anything without someone having an imagination to promote this idea, you know. So I will be discussing that in a 3-hour presentation,
mm-hmm.
on bridging the gap between the acoustic and the electric, where in the middle of all of this stuff, from my acoustic drum set will be another drum set that will be tied into the pickups that are used by Roland to enhance the sound of an acoustic set. So now you have two sounds. And then we move from there into the DDK-50s, which are fully electronic, and the whole idea of how to make and create a performance environment where you play by yourself, music minus one.
You guys have a nightly jam session also?
Every night.
That's awesome.
Every night. Yeah.
That's
you know, so you do
great.
You know two 3 hours of that, and the guys who did, the students who didn't participate during the day will be playing in the evening, and that's where we want to go.
That's going to be great. That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk a little bit about Miles Davis. You said the one thing you really learned from Miles was to match the people with the music. Talk about the time when you first hooked up with Miles. That was a good story.
Huh. Wow. Okay. So I was working. Was I working with Phil Woods or was I working with Mingus? I was Junior Mance, I think it might have been. I was at a place that is still exists right now, but called Art DeLugoff's Village Gate.
Right.
And the Village Gate was on Bleecker and Thompson, I think, something like that. And I think that they changed the name, but that place still is a club again in New York City. And I got a call. Oh, I know what. Jack DeJeanette was downstairs working with Miles. The club had two tiers. They had an upper room, which is like the top, called the top of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a Village Gate downstairs. And so Miles was playing there for, I don't know, a couple weeks or something. And upstairs came, this is the band with Wayne, I think Dave Holland or Roger Hawkins, which is a bass player from Washington, Miles uses sometimes.
Right.
Jack and Chick Corea was in the band. So what happened was that I'm in the middle of a show. I finished playing and Jack comes up and says, Billy, would you be interested in playing with Miles? And I said, I don't know. Would I? You know, it's vaguely. I said, of course. I said, yeah. You know, he said, well, okay. You mind if I give him your number and have him, you know, you can call him, or he'll call you and see what's happening. And so next thing I know, I said, yeah, man. And so the following day, I lived in the Village and not too far from there.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't in the house, and I had a girlfriend and was getting ready for work, and the phone call came. She picked up the phone and said, hello. Where's your boyfriend? I said, I'm on the phone. She said, hello? I said, who is this? Where is he? Who is this? So without getting into any expletives, she hung up on him. And she was not happy. And when I came in, I said, okay, what's happening? You know, well, why are you looking like that? She said, some AH was with a few other words, calling the phone. I hate that kind of stuff with these people, you know?
Yeah.
I'm going, oh, yeah, it's a drag. You know, you got to take the good with the bad, blah, blah, blah. She said, and something said, check. I said, so what did he say? You know, that got you so upset? She said, I couldn't understand him. I went, oh, no. I said, what do you mean you couldn't understand him? She said, well, he's whispering all the time. I said, what?
Funny. You do a great imitation of Miles, by the way.
Yeah. So I said, I don't know, but is he some friend of yours? I said, well, could be. So I said, did you leave my number? She said, but I didn't take it down. I called some people. I got the number. Called, and I said, I said, wow. I said,
be in my place 9 o'clock tomorrow.
Okay. And hung up. He knew exactly who I was.
That's
and so
funny.
The rest was history. You know?
Yeah, you know, his voice got raspier as he got older, too. I wonder what caused that. Was he a smoker, or was it just from the trumpet?
He had an operation.
He did, on his throat?
Yeah, and on his vocal cords, and he spoke too soon, and it was never...
Oh, okay.
He couldn't fix it.
I mean, he sounded hip. You know, the voice was hip.
That's another story for another day. I mean, that all that stuff... That jazz stuff and hip and all of that stuff up in smoke, man. Yeah. There's a lot to that one too. Oh boy, if anybody ever got into that stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Imagine Miles today. You know, if he's still around.
Uh huh.
You know that.
He would be a welcome. He would be a welcome information. He only became, to his benefit, I think. I mean, you know, Miles never won a Grammy ever.
Isn't that something?
It's not something. It is what it is. But again, he was. It was a question of how he was posed in the overall general picture of music. And he was. They called him the Prince of Darkness. They called him his blackness. All this kind of stuff. But that seemed to give a feeling of negativity, he was a person with the biggest gun in the world. You know, it's like that he's going to kill everybody.
Right.
He was giving that feeling actually, and he made the best of it that he possibly could. Not that he had any choice.
Yep.
And the end is did what he did. But on the other side, acknowledgement only by the musicians really when it came down to it.
Right.
There was a lot of envy, which is normal. That's a social negative side of our lives socially, and jealousy, of course, and many people seeking to undermine someone who may or may not be threatening to them. I don't know, but it's just life, man. You know, if some of us have to go through it on the other side, that's the yin and yang of it all. So do what you can.
Right. Mm-hmm. I know Miles recorded So What. I think he did it in like 7 hours, and there was a lot of improvisation in the beginning of the songs and whatever. Kind of reminded me a little bit of Spectrum, because didn't you guys record that pretty quickly?
Well, yeah. I mean, I had 2 3-hour sessions on one day. I think that happened in the whole record was done in 2 days. And then, so if we started, let's say hypothetically on a Tuesday, Tuesday night, we recorded Thursday, we started on Tuesday, recorded Wednesday, recorded, finished on Thursday, roughs. We were in London mixing on Friday, and we finished mixing on Saturday night in London. I was in New York on Monday the following week with the record. Done.
That's a great
album.
I
came in $10,000 under budget, and I started with $30,000, so I was happy.
Oh, wow. Excellent. A lot of people, a lot of artists that I interview, they always talk about Tommy Boland, what a nice guy he was. And
he was an angel, man. As far as I'm concerned, he was meant to be here only for a short time.
Really?
It was just one of those things. You know, I couldn't find anything wrong with him. I didn't know anything wrong with him. But then, see, people talk about Miles. I didn't have a problem with Miles, but everybody else seemed to have. They knew him a lot better than I did, and I thought that he was just a great person.
Sure.
He was very knowledgeable, and I received a lot of respect from him. He wasn't afraid to tell me when I was doing something silly, but at the same time, I never had a problem, ever. Mm-hmm. And with Tommy, he was just, to me, he was like, somebody just said, you know, this is what the world could be like. And they put this little kid in there.
Right.
And he drew our attention to things that I never knew about before, at least, you know, and I'm not expecting myself to be. Every time I learn something different, I go, wow, I didn't know that. Well, here's this kid that I can't even remember at the time. Well, he died at 27. So that was around 76 or 77. So he had to be in his teens when I
mm-hmm. That's okay. Right.
Well, no, that's not true. When I first met him in 69, somewhere there. So when Dreams was happening, and I went, wow, man, this guy was playing with an Echoplex, doing things with an Echoplex mm-hmm. and a bottle, bottle top. I mean, it's like, how? And I remember when we all first heard it, we went, okay, what's that? How did he do that? How did he do? We were in a big race car. The band was playing. We were opening to like Grand Funk Railroad or somebody. And the first band on the bill that afternoon was Zephyr, and it was his band.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
We went down and check out, what is this cat doing, man? How? The band was okay, but this guitar player was a whole other thing.
Yeah.
And Elvin went, get out of here. How you do that? And it just went from that point on. He played blues and the whole rock thing. He had such a, he reminded me of Kenny Kirkland. Oh,
right.
Kenny Kirkland reminded me of him.
Right,
I still
right.
don't know where he came from. I mean, he was from around my neighborhood. But
mm-hmm.
what the wealth of information this piano player had at such a young age was just off the hook crazy. And it's the same thing with Tommy Bolin. It's you know, these things happen and then they go poof, gone. You know, into another dimension or what? I don't know.
Now, Tommy got to play with Deep Purple and James Gang,
mm-hmm.
too, you
yeah.
know, later on down. Yeah.
Right.
Good guitar player. I got to hear the story. Last time we chatted, you told me a great story that all musicians should hear, especially the ones that are trying to make it in the business. When you were working with McCoy Tyner, you try to let it all hang out, and when you look back at the recording, you apologize for it.
Well, actually, yeah, I never dreamt that I would ever play with McCoy again. Not, it wasn't that I got fired. It was just like shift passing in the night. So we're talking 1977, thereabouts.
Right.
And I get called to do a McCoy Tyner date. And at Fantasy, I think it was, the studios. So I go, and it's the strangest recording session. I mean, McCoy is playing on a sine wave D with no top on it. It needs no microphones. It is one of the biggest sounding pianos ever made, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so loud and so accurate, beautiful sound. It just fills the room and completely, on the negative side, blankets everybody else in the band, you know? So the band that we have are like, it's like a bunch of straight players in the corner, a harpist involved, Ron Carter's behind a big plexiglass baffle, because otherwise you don't hear the bass, period. And Hubert Laws was playing flute. Who else was in it? I don't know who else was in the band at that time. Piano? Oh, McCoy, of course, myself. And I don't think there was a guitar player, no. And so it was Fly With The Wind. Oren Keekley, who's great producer, was there for it and was controlling all the stuff. And what I found was that as soon as I heard McCoy, I said, man, I'm going to get a chance to come. This is going to be probably my only chance to come close to playing with John Coltrane.
Right.
Because,
yep.
You know, McCoy is my bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to give it my best shot. And I forgot about the music, man. I just went totally off the wall, everything I could possibly think of on every tune. And at the end, I walked away almost like as if I had just won a track race. And I realized later on when I heard the record, I said, God, I'm playing so much. I'm playing too much. It didn't require that.
Right.
And I'm very, very sorry that I did it. And it was a lesson for me, again, another lesson well learned, that you come, and it wasn't because of McCoy, it was because of training. I wanted to be like Elvin. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just play with reckless abandon, but play musically, because Elvin Jones was one of the most musical drummers ever in existence. Like Roy Haynes in a completely different way, or Max Roach. They had these personalities. And I just went like hell bent off the deep end and did all of this stuff. And I don't know. I never listened to the record anymore. I listened two or three times and went, nah, that was a mistake. I understand that I made a big mistake with that. And that was 1977. I never saw McCoy again on the bandstand until the early, in around 2000, 2004 or 5.
Mm-hmm.
I was invited to work with him in trio with Stanley Clark.
Right.
And I had such a wonderful time because I wanted to kind of musically fix some things that I did. And we played a lot of good tunes, and I had a ball. That was the last time I played with it, but I feel very much vindicated now. You know, I feel so much better.
But you're the only one that noticed that it was not right, I guess, to your liking of perfection.
Right.
Though it was just you, right? Pretty much.
I guess. Well, people will say, Betty Maupin said, "Man, that's the best record I ever heard you play on."
Right.
I went, "Really?" It's not something that I really like. I don't know if you're familiar with the drummer in Dugu, Chancellor.
Mm-hmm.
He's from California, and he worked with Weather Report for a while.
Right.
And in there was it wasn't Mysterious Traveler, but he made a record that was completely white. He had, the album cover, the sleeve is white. And I can't remember the name of it, but there's some amazing music on there. And the way he plays, I love it. It's the best record I've ever heard him play on, and he can't stand it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just the way it is. But I honestly, truly learned so much from listening to him play that record. You know, and it's just so nicely the treatment. You know? I don't know if it was done in real time or how they did it. But the end product left me with that positive feeling. And so I get it. It's like George Duke, when we were talking,
mm-hmm.
And he said, man, we need to go out and put out the outtakes from Cobble Duke Live. And he sent me some stuff to listen to. And you see, that's the funny thing about me, I guess. I listened to it and I didn't like it at all. I thought that I overplayed.
Right.
But that was 1976,
mm-hmm.
and that was a young Billy Cobham,
right,
who was thinking a completely different way. When I heard what I did, I had to tell George, I said, man, I think you guys played amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I said, but I didn't like the way the drummer sounded at all.
Yeah.
I thought it was, you know, it's like, why am I doing all of that? You know, and this was also after I had experienced the same kind of feeling when I was asked to revisit the music of the Mahavishnu Orchestra, but
mm-hmm.
playing it with a jazz orchestra.
Right.
And at first I said, no, I don't want to go there at all. And then Gary Husband, who was playing with the Frankfurt Radio Big Band or somebody like this, said, man, what would happen if you thought about it as, well, what would happen if I go back to it now, 30 years, 40 years later, to see how I would treat the same music now in comparison,
sure,
to how I did it then? And it kind of, that put the light on in my head. I went, actually, that'd be fun, you know? But just to play it for the sake of playing it again, I'm of that school of Miles, which said, I already did that, you know.
Right, right.
But then I thought, hey, you know, I've grown. I wonder how, with a different organization, and this is instead of a five-piece band, we're talking 22 pieces, French horns, tuba, blah, blah. Yeah, okay. And so I went, we did that, and then we did, what else? We did something else. Oh, I took it to Australia, mm-hmm. and I funded personally the performance of the music of the Mahavishnu Orchestra with 100 pieces with the Adelaide Symphony Orchestra, where all of the violins played with Lachlan's guitar part. And I had a ball.
Is there any chance of you and John collaborating once more? Getting together again?
No, there isn't really. To be quite honest, I think we're maybe pretty shot. I hear he's about to retire the next day or so.
Is he really? I know he still hits the road once in a while.
Well, he's on the road or was on the road this year once, and I think this was his last year playing live.
Right.
Yeah.
We'll have to get you and Jeff Beck together.
Now, that would be an interesting situation. And we have toyed with that idea, but the problem is that Jeff's just not comfortable with it for whatever the reason is, and I respect that. So we don't talk about it very much. But
yeah.
He's good people. He's good people.
Yeah, it'd be a good band. I tell you that. It'd be a great band. You know what I love on YouTube is that Art Blakey, you and Simon Phillips in Montreux in 1982.
Yes, I
what
know.
What a video, man. That is incredible.
Yeah, you should have seen the backstage scene. Thank God they didn't document that. That was fascinating, too.
Really?
But there we go. We won't talk about that now.
That was an awesome video. All your videos on YouTube are awesome. You can't,
thank
you know.
You.
Yeah, they're mm-hmm. great, man.
Thank you. Yeah.
Now you got some upcoming dates coming. I want to announce them. Uh-huh. You got the Billy Cobham Band on May 13th in Italy, right? At the is it the Ravenna Jazz Festival?
Oh, Ravenna Jazz, yeah. Good Lord, man. We've got more stuff going on. You can shake a stick at, and I can hardly keep up. I just asked my wife to keep because she's my manager. So just mm-hmm. point me in the right direction. That's good enough for me. I'll just whatever we need to do, I'll be there. But we're on tour from, as far as I know, in May, but I don't have dates.
I've got June 12th through the 17th. You'll be at Ronnie Scott's in London.
Oh, yeah, but that's what's special about that.
Yeah.
Is that,
now is Jerry Goodman playing with you as well? Or
No.
Okay, somebody said that. I didn't know.
No. That is different. I'm playing all of my music. I don't know if you have my big band album. I did one with Frankfurt Radio Big Band. All of my tunes.
Right.
And so we're doing another one with an updated version of a lot of the old material from the Crosswinds album, because that's coming is the Crosswinds project, which is going to feature Tim Landers from Glass Menagerie and Ernie Watts from my early bands.
Oh, great.
And that starts in November.
Okay.
Where we'll play jazz, no jazz, and then we'll take that into 2018. And we'll be recording a record and with that quintet as well. But that said, not to get ahead of myself, the project in June will be kind of unique for me because I haven't, it's a first, after 30-something years or thereabouts, I'm actually, because I am a photographer, I'm showing my work in London at the Leica Camera galleries in Mayfair.
Oh, cool.
London. And it's 24 selected pieces that I'm showing some portraits and as you mentioned about the Bahamas thing where the Compass Point, the album covers that I've shot, like Horace's album cover, Funky Thylacines, Crosswinds, that kind of stuff, that will be there. That is the first time that I'm showing stuff since the Vincent Kling Galleries in Philadelphia in 1984-85.
Hmm.
Just never had a chance to get to put things together again. And now I'm getting back into that situation where I'm starting to show my art. And at the same time in the evening, I'm performing with a semblance of musicians from the BBC Orchestra,
right.
New works by me at the Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club for a week.
Can we check out any of your works online? maybe on your website or
anything? Yeah, just go go to my Facebook page. You'll see it. Yeah, it's all there, man. It's all there.
Yeah, it's kind of like a side job to a lot of artists. Julian Lennon does that as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Lots of musicians. The sonic and the visual go hand in hand. And the two different, one that is one picture where you hear things and envision it, and one picture where you see things and then create sonic images around that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's where I want to go with that. I don't know, you're not probably too old enough to remember that. You ever went to the Fillmore East?
Oh yeah, sure. I've never been there, but yeah, I remember the Fillmore East.
You only remember it, but you never were there. Okay, but there was a company called Pig Lights.
Okay.
And Pig Lights had the 35 they used to show on a big white screen in the back.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Just abstract images all the time. They kept flowing in and out of each other.
Yep.
That's what I want to do in my show.
Awesome.
Take a lot of my digital images and incorporate them into a presentation that where the music represents them.
That'll be cool. Insane.
And it's becoming more and more it's doable. It's definitely doable now where we couldn't, unless you were, Michael Jackson or something, forget it.
Yeah.
But you can do that now, and it could be a lot of fun. If it's set up properly, it can be a very, very nice thing to do.
Now, are you going to do any more dates in the U.S.? Come back to Florida, maybe?
I would love to if I only knew. We tried to do that. It was a guy named Michael Franklin or something. I don't know, something like that. He was supposed to do something down there, but he just disappeared on me, man. Never heard from him again. We were supposed to do something come spring, and he went to ground, I guess, or he got something else better to do, so I haven't heard from him. So I assume it's not happening. But I would love to play the United States. My dream would be to do a road tour of the USA. But what I'm asking for is the moon. I mean, it's that is just not possible, apparently, to happen where you get in a bus with a band and you tour the United States. As if you were some politician with no money.
Yeah.
But there you go. That's another story for me.
You know what would be cool? You know all these shows like, Ringo's All-Star Band and where they get all the these classic rock guys together? They should do the same thing with jazz. All the classic jazz guys together and do a tour. That'd be awesome.
Well, the reason why you don't see that is that there's a very big reason. And that's because jazz is not designed to be a community platform.
Right.
Unfortunately, most of the artists in jazz are divided and are extremely sensitive about who is the leader, whose music will be played, how much time will we have. It becomes quite competitive when you get a whole, bunch of jazz musicians together. No matter what they say, they're very, very intellectual. They're very, very, they have a high level of competency, but they're only thinking about themselves. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it's not so easy to just go and put a band together without somebody saying, well, whose music are we playing? I got some tunes. But they really don't care whether the music is connected to the individuals, other individuals or not.
Right.
Quite frankly, they're just worried about protecting their own particular position because they're desperate to not lose that. There's not too many other things they have, and that's a big problem. So therefore, you're not going to see that so fast.
That's a shame, though.
It is what it is. It is what it is. And as I'm saying this, I'm saying, now, that's going to go out, and there's going to be people will scream. But they know it's true, absolutely true.
I didn't realize Buddy Rich was so hard on his players. He cursed and threatened and did all kinds of things to some of the musicians. He was as a band leader. Yeah.
Well, you got to understand, it's not just. There's a reason for that. You
yeah.
Know?
Yep.
It's coming from a history. It's almost like, you know, mom and dad brought up a kid in a bad way. Mm-hmm. So the kid now becomes a thief or a murderer, and it kills other people, because he's not taking it out on the other people. He's taking it out on mom and dad, who aren't existing anymore. You know, and I think that that's a social problem that can be fixed. You know, some, it's not always the same, that way, but yes, in effect, more often than not, if a child is molested or treated poorly, or if a dog is treated, I mean, any being, if that element of negativity is there, that's what they know, and mm-hmm. that's what they do,
yeah.
Okay? And there's nothing one, you know, so who knows what Rich went through? But what came out on the other side, not that it is at the same level, but he had this special genius that he mm-hmm. played. Once he was playing, he was inside himself and he was having a ball. He didn't
right.
want anyone to take that away from him. So
yep.
that was partially one way of protecting himself. And also, when he's, you know, unfairly to the other musicians, he played with literally some of the greatest
right.
musicians ever to live on this face of the earth.
Right.
When you play with those kind of people, it's very, very difficult for anyone else to come and measure up.
Have you ever had a band leader just lose it and tell all the other musicians off, that kind of thing?
No, no.
No? Yeah.
No, not at all. Not at
yeah.
all. That and again, you know, it's like there's some things you just don't do.
Right, right.
Especially if you're looking for support. But what
yep.
I have had as a drummer in the band, because I wrote music for the band, was to deal with a tremendous amount of competition because of the ludicrous, silly thought process that drummers are not musicians. You know, and that was started in America. That was started in jazz
right.
as a joke. But unfortunately, a lot of people, as I said, we talk about rewards and awards and all of that. If you don't know the right people and the marketing is incorrect, you're going to be hurt. Or if that's what you're looking for. If you're looking
right.
for acknowledgement that you're the greatest at what you do and you don't know the right people that can promote that,
right.
then you're gonna feel it.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, if you are in the right place and you play well, but someone sees in you a personality, something that's marketable to a large population where they can exploit you in that way, then hey, the problem is of you not being that great but good enough. Only comes to the surface far down the road if you have that chance when these people have already made you a star.
Yep.
Now you don't really have to play. People are looking for you to just be who you are, which was always what it was. But now you have someone else extracting bucks payment for life because you've gotten into bed with the devil. You know, that's who it is, and
right.
that's the way it is. So you are not yourself, really. You are who they decided and created you to
right.
be.
Exactly.
That's also, depending on who the individual is.
Yep.
I have no problem with that. You know, it's just the way things are, depending on how things work. So I mean, I just stay open and just watch, and you know, at the end of the day, you go, well, at least I got in on the card game. I got it. You know, so whatever the mess is that I'm holding in my hand, I'll have to just play that and be happy with it. No problem.
Well, Billy, I want to thank you so much, man, for being on the show today. I've got you as far as the top drummers of all time. I really think you're my number one pick. You know, Rolling Stones got you not even the top five. I hate Rolling Stone. Never liked them. Half the time, they don't know what they're talking about. Back in the day, they were good. You know, back in the 60s, early 70s. But then he started getting political, and they got away from the music, and they started putting Justin Bieber on the front cover. They lost it. You know, they're not all about the music anymore. But I've got you number one. You know, I really think you're that great of a drummer.
Thank you.
I appreciate everything you've done, and you're helping people now, educating them, and you're doing all the right things, man. I really appreciate what you do.
Well, thank you very much. And the whole objective is also that I'm doing what I feel is right, that I feel happy doing. I'm comfortable with what I'm working with, and only hope to, you know, just to try to find a way to keep to sustain it and maintain it. You know, I mean, where Rolling Stone is concerned, it's like I was in a band called the Jack Bruce's Friends with David Sanchez and Clem Clemson and myself and Jack, and we made one record called "I Always Wanted to Do This." It was on Columbia. And the big claim to fame for Rolling Stone was that they voted it the worst record ever made that year.
Really?
And we felt so happy that they gave us that monocle, because it was burning as far as we were concerned. We had a great time making the record, and if we had another chance, we'd do more. You know, Jack's not here, so there you go.
You're talking about Jack Bruce?
Yeah.
I interviewed Jack. He what a great guy. I interviewed him like months before he passed away, you know?
Yeah. What a sweetheart. Yeah, I mean, he was a bull in the china shop when it comes to playing bass. I mean, all the notes were right, but they were in your face. And, you know, it was quite Scottish. But on the other hand, when he sang and he played piano, it was tremendously emotional, man. It's like he was one of my all-time favorite male rock vocalist by far. Great, and again, a very, very knowledgeable man about the business, man. About art and the music. I mean, he did his homework. Beautiful stuff.
People don't realize, you know, a lot of those Cream songs were written by Jack. You know, they always think of Clapton, but he was
No. Yeah. White Room is Jack, man.
That's Jack.
All Jack. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Billy, thank you again, man, for being here. I'd like to get you on again in the future to catch up to what you're doing.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you get the time, or, you know, if you need help or anything getting here to Florida, let me know.
I'm letting you know.
Okay.
If you know I got a good venue
for you here in close to Clearwater. And I actually helped oh my God! I'm losing it, man. I'm having one of those senior moments.
You have
Corky Lang. I helped Corky Lang. Corky Lang. I got him the venue.
Yeah.
So it's a good place, and you know the Zombies have played there, and they get a lot of good groups over there. I think it'd be a good venue for you. Guarantee
a
sellout.
Okay.
All right, man. Thank you so much, Billy.
Okay, Ray. You take care, man.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
You can purchase Spectrum 40 Live at Amazon.com, the Billy Cobham Art of the Rhythm Section Retreat. Enrollment for the program is now open, with spaces limited for each of the four instrument categories of drums, guitar, bass, and keyboards. For more information and to register, visit www.BillyCobhamRetreat.com. For more information about Billy Cobham and very latest news and concert dates, visit www.billycobham.com. Billy's also on Facebook at www.facebook.com/officialBillyCobham. And he's on Twitter, Billy Cobham at GladBash. Very special thanks to Nancy Balick, Communications PR Director, for arranging this interview, and Doug and Don Newsome with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Join me bi-weekly Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at ray@publicityworksagency.com. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book, entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, or the second edition, entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to Be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C. Available now at Amazon.com. You will live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio, Station 1.